the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, Brains.
Coming to you straight from San Diego, California, let's welcome our host, April Mahoney.
What are you doing? You've converted your garage into your office,
right? Yeah. I converted my garage into my office back in March, and which is, you know, cost effective because I can't, you know, don't want to pay for an office.
No, who wants a brick and mortar now? That's right. Just obsolete when everything is virtual.
I do just park in my car in the garage, but that's fine. But I'm going to be converting this garage into a virtual auction studio.
Really?
Yeah, it's probably going to be up and running in a month. So that nonprofits who can't readily afford to hire a big AV company and put on a big production will have me as an option.
Wow. Well, I'm telling you, they got a winner. You know what I did? I snuck in here and converted Mr. Magnificent's man cave. Well, I try to get out of here before 4:30 before he comes home from work. But thank you so much, Zach Krohn, for being here on the Edge with me. Okay, I am so excited to have you. Let me tell you, I've done a lot of work with nonprofit, social services, and schools. And it's a different time now. Fundraising and development is my stick, or as my daughter says, my PB&J, my jam. Because I know how to make the ask, and I know how to close the deal. But you know how to sell it. And I have had an opportunity to watch some of your videos on YouTube and just some of the great work you've done. I know you've raised over a gazillion dollars. So I've asked you to come on the Edge to talk to my brains a little bit about what fundraising and development looks like in today's environment, because it's changed considerably. As I said, once upon a time, you know, you could get $1,500 a plate and fill the room and, you know, give a couple great auction items, a car, sometimes a house, and clean up. But now people are not gathering in the rooms. They are not, you know, giving their legacy donations the way that they were. So we need great people like you to really bring us up to speed as to what is happening. So Brains, without further ado, let me tell you, let me introduce you to Zach Krohn right there. That is the man. He is doing the most. Thank you so much for being here.
You are way too kind.
And no, I'm not.
That's quite an intro. Just manage your expectation, Brains. I don't know if I hope I can deliver after that intro.
You can.
That's very sweet.
Tell us a little bit about you and how this all started for you.
Good question. I'd say back in like 2006, 2007, I was an on-camera news reporter for Reuters. And I was hired to mainly do the entertainment pieces for, you know, red carpet gatherings of any sort, after parties, record releases, things like that. And that was fun for a while. Most of the male celebrities didn't like talking to me because I'm 6'2", so I was so much taller than them, which was kind of funny. But because of being on camera and being seen in different markets, because that's what Reuters did, was sell their pieces to different markets. I was asked to be the MC at a bunch of different nonprofit fundraisers, big galas and, you know, socialite affairs. And it was always fun. And it was just a side thing for me to do. And, you know, it was on a volunteer basis. And every single one of these events that, you know, paid, I'm sure, a ton of money for their venue and their entertainment and their decor, whenever it came time to actually fundraise, I kept seeing the same problem, which was their hiring of a commercial auctioneer. Most people hear the word auctioneer and they think it's just like one guy talks fast, can sell anything. It's a much more specialty career now anyway than it was back then. So imagine being in a room full, semi-inebriated with a room full of socialites, and out comes a guy who's customarily liquidating assets and selling cars, couches, and cattle, going, it's interesting for like 10 seconds and then you tune out and it doesn't raise any money.
Right.
And so I kept seeing this over and over and over again, and people would just tune out and the nonprofit would suffer because they wouldn't raise the money necessary to justify the event. It was hurting the nonprofit field. And I knew I could do it. Background in television, improv, all this kind of stuff. My dad was a car, he was a general manager of a car dealership.
Oh, yeah.
Started as a car salesman. I used to go to car auctions. I kind of saw what to do and what not to do. And I was like, this needs something. This needs to be entertaining. This needs to be more interesting. This needs more. And whenever a celebrity tried to do the auction, it was the other side of the problem. They didn't know how to sell. They didn't know how to move the money along. They didn't know how to stay in front of the crowd. So there needed to be kind of a hybrid of that. And so the next time somebody asked me to be the MC, I said, I'll do your auction as well. And they were like, great, that saves us, you know, a lot of money. And so I did it and I loved it. My first one was like at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And I remember Christina Applegate bidding and laughing and just engaging the crowd on an entertainment basis because they paid a lot of good money to be there and they deserve to be entertained. So one became two became four became eight. And all of a sudden I was having more fun, feeling a little bit better about my position in life because I was raising money for a good cause rather than asking Hayden Panettiere what she was wearing that night.
Right.
And so there was validity in the position. So I was like, I love this. And I jumped right in. Shortly thereafter, I started working as a development director for an Orange County nonprofit, and I wanted to learn everything there was to learn about the nonprofit field. And I was essentially their closer. I was sent in to you know, go to the lunches, be on the phone, and get the big donations.
Right.
And I also went to auction school to make sure that I was doing it right, and I learned a lot there. There are auction schools. I went to the Worldwide College of Auctioneering, and it taught me a lot about the ethics and the laws and the chant, you know, and having a proficiency in all that. And so I can consult with nonprofits on what to do and what not to do. And so I think in 2011, I formed California Coast Auctions. And from there, we have steadily grown year after year. In 2019, we did 265 live events between myself and my team of seven other auctioneers. And a lot of them, we took from their genesis of getting into live events, and now a lot of them were on autopilot and doing really, really well and growing systemically as live events should, to where it becomes more about donations and cultivating donors and less about selling stuff.
Right.
So,
have you ever calculated how much money you've raised?
It changes from year to year. I mean, I would love to say it's all because of me generally auctioneers.
Team, right?
Yeah. I mean, auctioneers love to take credit even when it's not due. And so a lot of it, we help and consult. A big part of my job is the 9-to-5 is the consulting on making sure the pieces are where they need to be in order for the event to be successful. I'm kind of like an auxiliary committee member. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'm not responsible for bringing in the big donors. I am responsible for where they sit and, you know, they're interested in figuring out what their modality of giving is going to be so we can leverage that into more giving. Mm-hmm. But I can't take credit for all the money we've raised. I mean, I think on any given year, the average event is raising around $100,000.
Okay.
So, and then there's those events that come around once a month that are raising over $1 million. Mm-hmm. So I have...
The last gala I went to, my mentor, she raised $2.5 million in 45 minutes. And she didn't do a whole lot. She's very petite, very soft spoken. But let me tell you, she spoke to them and they gave handsomely. So again, like I said, it used to be the big galas, you know, everybody get dressed up. Have a great cocktail hour. You have the silent auction, and then you have the big giving. But now things have really changed. So what does that look like when you sit at the table with the board of directors of these nonprofits and social services, and they're biting their nails, wondering if they're going to be able to keep the doors open, wondering if they're still going to be able to service their client? What are you saying to them in those conversations about fundraising?
Are you freezing because of me or? All right. My signal must not be that strong. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. That's okay. I can edit it out. Don't worry about it.
So what am I want to understand the question. What am I telling groups to do now in the post-COVID-19?
What sort of suggestions and what are you saying that, you know, that they should look at and focus on, in the world of fundraising?
Well, I've always been a proponent of virtual fundraising even before COVID-19 because it was how the youth market chose to interact with their nonprofit modality, whether it be with Omaze or Charity Buzz or online auctions of some kind or another. So I was like, most people ask me, how do we get younger? How do we get new donors? And I said, you should start cultivating your virtual community now, put more focus in your social media, get the attention of the new generation, because that's how they consume their media. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we don't really see the percentages in that. And now virtual events have become the mainstay because it's the one thing you can do without having to postpone. Now's the time to experiment, and necessity breeds innovation.
Right.
You don't want to lose the sponsorship dollars that you've already garnished for your live event. So you have to put it into a platform in which you can sell and give your sponsors something like airtime. And you need to stay on top of your transactional donors. Transactional donors for a lot of nonprofits are the middle class donors, the people that make or break your nonprofit. Transactional donors are the types of people who give by impulse. They give once, they buy something, they buy a ticket, they give like in the $500 range in the fund of need, and they're usually interested in some sort of transaction of what they can get back in return rather than just donating. And someone over 60 is giving for their legacy. They're giving because their social circle, they have the money to give, they're pillars of the community. People under 40 are giving because they might win something, or they get to attend a party, or they get to do something. So you don't want to lose those donors, and you want to cultivate those relationships. So the virtual event is pretty much the only game in town you can do right now. And there's lots of different things like drive-in events and watch parties that you can develop a ticket price off of and generate funds that way. And I'm sure every catering company in Southern California and beyond is more than happy to work right now. And in a lot of ways, we're the only cameras rolling.
Right. You know, most
no business is shut down. So this is a great way to, if you do it right, if you make them entertaining and you make them worth watching, this is a great way to cultivate new donors, to get younger, to usher in your new generation, and to set the stage for a new revenue stream that isn't going away.
Right.
Even when the storm passes and we're able to do live events, the proposition of doing so is going to have a very limited cost benefit ratio compared to before, because the cost of the venues have gone up to have new safety protocols. The headcount that's allowed in that venue has gone down because of physical distancing. And your constituency as a nonprofit is going to be hesitant about gathering. You know, would you pay $500 to go to a venue and have to wear a mask the whole time? You know, and your constant exposure to the public. So live events are going to move outdoors, and they're going to be held at different times of year at alternative schedules. And you still got your immune compromised, your senior citizens, your agoraphobic, your germophobic people that aren't going to be as engaged with a live event as we have been in the past. So cultivating.
It's very interesting because I attended a virtual gala. And it was the coolest thing. I still got to dress up. I donated my ticket price. I donated my cocktail money. I donated money for my silent auction. And it was all virtual. And we all came together via Zoom. And they raised a ton of money. They, you know, $10,000, $11,000. But again, like you said, they need to have a template and it needs to be done right. And you still need to have an auctioneer, someone to facilitate it, because they need to go through the steps, the process. They need to introduce the donors. They need to keep the audience engaged and fun. You shared something with me that really touched my heart and resonated with me about Jerry Lewis.
Yep.
I think it was Labor Day, September. Every September, Jerry Lewis had his muscular dystrophy telethon. Entertain, get some money. Entertain, get some money. Entertain, get some money. He was consistent, and he was, you know, a pioneer when it came to this. So this is nothing new or innovative. It's just how you design it and the quality of entertainment. So you're doing something like that coming up soon, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. All these events need to have a balance of reciprocity of entertainment value, because we lost the party. We lost the gathering. We lost the dress up and the eating together and the live bands and the dancing. So we have to entertain them through this mode, through the screen, which is televised based entertainment. So, and Jerry Lewis figured that out a long, long time ago. So we're just reinventing the wheel, where you intermittent and have that reciprocity between entertainment and giving. So I have events coming up where we're getting former NFL stars that are associated with this nonprofit to hold a trivia game show style thing about the NFL. And it's going to be like round of trivia, auction item, round of trivia, auction item. There's another event I'm talking to about pretty much copying the Comic Relief Aid format from the 90s, where it was ask for money, comedian, ask for money, comedian, ask for money, comedian, and so on and so forth. And the more name talent you get involved, kind of the better it is to promote and get more people engaged and wanting to watch and building it systemically from there. You only get the one chance for that first impression. So there's some really cute ones we're doing too. Like I'm working with a hospital. So we're going to play Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader, more or less.
Oh my goodness.
We're going to take three doctors and three kids and play trivia with them. And you're going to get to know these people as we go. I was just talking to an animal rescue thing, and we're going to hold a basset hound race, not the fastest of creatures. Oh. And we're going to get to know the dogs prior to they were all rescued, what situation they came from, and how happy and healthy they are now with their new owners. And you're going to want to root for them. And you get that fish hook scenario where you want to know what's going to happen next. And that's the same model that television uses. Essentially, the fundraising has become the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, absolutely.
So even though fundraising is the primary goal, audience engagement is a much more macro goal for the expansiveness of the virtual fundraising revenue stream.
Right.
Because it's, like I said, it's not going anywhere because the castle walls are low.
Right, right. Well, let me dial back a little bit, because I want to touch on something. The very philanthropic millennials, you know, because they're still giving, but they are giving to specific causes. They are looking for clean water. They're looking for renewable energy. They're looking for anti-gun. They may have some political associations. How do mm-hmm. we resonate with them? You know, how do you make something engaging to them? You know, do you have to get you a TikTok? they communicate different, you know, and they're already online, but, you know, are they going to be as engaged? How do you tap into them and get them encouraged about giving?
Well, first of all, social media should have already been a major part of the marketing and publicity for nonprofits anyway, to usher in a new generation of donors. And, you know, you should be posting something on Instagram every single day, whether an Instagram live video or a showcasing of a certain benefactor. If there's one positive thing, and there are many, as a self-spoken millennial, I'm 38, so I'm
just a baby.
I'm right on the bubble. They are more sympathetic towards causes. But it takes engagement. That's really the part that's missing. You can't just turn to governments and corporations to pull this off.
Right.
It really does take that village, that sense of collective community to come together and find that cause that's meaningful for you. And yes, they do have a higher tendency to support causes that are secular, that are environmental, and that can initiate change on a grand scale. I think change needs to start at home. It needs to start at the community-based level. Like, if you want to change the environment, that's great. You could donate to a big nonprofit. But that big nonprofit is essentially working on Capitol Hill as a special interest group. Mm. So they're trying to initiate change through that.
Yes, right. But
if you want a park to get built in your neighborhood, you know, that like LA Neighborhood Land Trust or something like that, then I think it's important for those causes to market towards the millennial group now, because that's where you can really see the change. You can really be you're not going to give to some big, huge kind of corporate nonprofit.
Right.
So I think it's very important for millennials to be aware of that. And there's only three ways to get someone to give or engage. And I think the ASPCA figured this out a long time ago. You either inspire, you motivate, or you incentivize. Those are the three things that compel someone to give. So you're inspiring them with the stories, with the personal resonance, with the connection for the better sense of humanity in the world. You motivate with things that are more cerebral, like for every dollar you give, it will be matched. Or, you know, $30 a month saves the life of this puppy. Or, you know, there's other motivating factors that, that come into play as well.
Absolutely.
And then you incentivize. What can you literally get back? And if you donate to the ASPCA and save the life of this puppy, we're going to give you the ASPCA t-shirt.
Right.
You know, or we're going to enter you into an opportunity drawing to win XYZ simply for giving. You know, here's every time I see a lot, I get a lot of stuff in the mail for a lot of the nonprofits that I support. Like, you know, I love to support environmental causes when it comes to our state parks. And so I get these, you know, wonderful calendars and shirts and canvas bags and things like that. With pictures of
now, I get it. You get the stuff. I get it now.
I mean, they all get it. I mean, that's the thing. That's they understand that it's an exchange of goods. It's usually, you know, it's not equal. You know, your a t-shirt is not $30, and
but appreciation and it's like an acknowledgement, and it also shows support. I mean, you know, that's like when people with my logo or they
it's the Girl Scout bag.
Yeah, exactly. It's a give back. It's saying, hey, yeah, I'm totally in this with you. You know,
it's a sign of merit for sure.
Exactly.
Pretty much every t-shirt I own is a nonprofit.
I know, and I've done a lot of nonprofits. I mean, I've done the fashion shows, and we've done the golf tournaments, and the you know, the virtual cocktail parties, all of these things. So people are giving at a much lower rate. Maybe I shouldn't say all that. You know, I'm not seeing a lot of legacies like it used to be, because that was more the mindset of, you know, our older parents that said, you know what, I'm going to support the American Red Cross until I die because they helped us with the last pandemic, you know? And so in my will, I'm going to leave them $500,000. So I don't know how we're going to really get millennials to have that train of thought. But again, like you said, if it's organizations that they believe in, causes that they believe in, you know, they can do it at a small level. I have one particular nonprofit that I'm in love with, and they're in Los Angeles, and they're called the Homeboys. And Homeboys, I'm sure you know all the nonprofits, but they really work with disadvantaged ex-offenders and you know, kids that have been on drugs or in gangs, and they have their own, it's now called Homeboy Industries.
Right, they make salsa and tortilla chips.
They do, and they are in, what, they're in Whole Foods now.
Huge.
You know, and they're teaching them how to be good parents, and they're getting their tattoos removed, and they're showing them how to work a commercial kitchen. You know, that's what I'm hoping that nonprofits also incorporate, is a way to be self-sustainable.
Sure.
Because, you know, all this giving is tough.
Right.
And people are not giving, and they're looking for grants. And if you're not already in that funnel of grants, it's going to be hard to get in there. So, you know, I'm thinking things like a women's shelter. You know, partner with a great cosmetic company and get your own line of nail polish. And each bottle of nail polish, you get something from there. You know, at-risk youth in some of these schools, teach them how to install solar panels. You know, water pumps, sustainability. You're teaching them a skill. You're teaching them mathematics. It's cutting edge technology, but it's always a way to give back.
Yep.
You know, you want to talk about training programs. Really, what is the ROI, as you said, for me giving and donating? You know, I'm just not writing a check.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people think that not all nonprofits, but some nonprofits, once you give that check, it's really not a tax deduction. So again, if you're giving and you're philanthropic, you're giving from your heart. Do that first, brains. Give from your heart and your commitment. Don't try to worry about a tax write-off. So let's talk about schools. Schools are a very different animal.
Sure.
And I know a lot of teachers that go into their own pockets to support schools.
Which is a shame.
Books and pens and all that, considering all the tax money that I know I'm paying, and I don't have no little kids. So what do you say to schools? You know, how do you really engage them? Because it used to be great to get that cookie dough. I don't know why they ever stopped that. Or you used to get those toffee-coated peanuts. I love that. And the calendars. Those are still very viable options, but they don't do that anymore. What are schools doing to raise money?
Well, schools are definitely a different animal. Are we talking private schools or public schools? Because that's a different animal in and of itself.
Okay, well, let's start with, you know, because I know that the private schools probably have some donors. and some legacies and some very philanthropic people. So let's talk about the regular public schools.
Okay. So the failings of the state of California with how much they appropriate towards schools is a very big issue, and it's a very controversial issue. And we pay the highest state income tax, and we, you know, pay the highest gas tax, and all the stuff that's supposed to go towards schools, and it hasn't. And school bonds, that money gets reallocated. It seems like whenever the state needs money, they take it away from schools. So schools, parents, individuals are left kind of holding the bag. So public schools need to pretty much fundraise the same way private schools do, which is through cultivating of a community. That's one thing that like private schools do a lot differently than public schools is they're much more, I believe if you treat a donor like family, they'll behave like family. And I think that should apply to parents as well.
Well, you want to be careful because some family members is cray cray.
Exactly. And it's definitely a mixed bag out there with different parents and different teachers. And, right. You know, everyone loves to give their opinion. And that's what you got to be careful at a private school. If you give an opinion and you say, hey, we should change this about the school, or we should get faster internet, or we should get more computers, they're going to turn around and say, great, what are you going to do to institute that? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do to get the money to pull that off? Because we love that idea.
Right, right.
But everyone wants to, you know, order from the menu, but no one wants to pick up the check. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the workload that you're investing back into the school. So it always comes down to community. Never doubt that the impact that a community can have. That it, as soon as you give power to your doubt, you're giving doubt to your power. It's a terrible thing. So put your energy into these positive solutions is what I would tell these parents. If you want to see change, you have to make it on a community basis, because like even public schools in certain, like, let's say middle class, even lower middle class areas, certain schools are going to thrive based off of the parent body that they built around it, whether through right. PTAs, the volunteer work that parents are doing it, and how engaged their parents are in the school and extracurricular activities. It's been proven time and time again that like the schools that raise the most amount of money for their football program are going to generate more revenue for the school and attract more talent because they invested in themselves. Mm-hmm. So public school is not free, as we all know. You're just going through an intermediary like the state government or the district that reallocates funds to their own liking. So it really, just like a nonprofit, it's direct to the cause. You know, I like to find those middle level nonprofits that you are donating directly to them and not to some overall hierarchy.
Right, right.
Where the money gets, like if you're supporting, I, you know, I don't want to use any nonprofit's name specifically because I don't know their internal workings, but is the money that you're donating to that particular chapter going to that region, or is it going to DC or New York? Or
right, we had that. The nonprofit that I work with was major, and so we had that. It went to the corporate, and then sprinkling and sprackling, you know, of went to certain chapters. And so you had an option at that time to say, okay, I want my donation to go specifically to this specific area.
Right. So parents and teachers, I love what you're saying about having a product. And this is something Paul Newman figured out decades ago with his salad dressing. So if you have something that's distinctly yours that you can market and sell, that's, you know, at least generating awareness, and, you know, people should be walking around with t-shirts of your school. So people are aware that that school is, you're putting that message out there that you're proactive and not just, you know, lazy about it. It's it's kind of funny how, you know, parents would blame teachers for their kids' behavior and now the kids are at home being homeschooled and going, oh, this isn't the teacher's fault.
Right. They had no idea who that little person was. They kept reading those notes, you know, home. Right. Now they have a clear idea, you know, and even with that, you know, we're going back and forth and back here in California. Do we send our kids to school? Don't we send our kids to school? Right. But again, that is another kind of co-op. That's another kind of relationship that we need to build as parents.
Exactly. A school is not a building. A school is a cooperation between teachers, administrators, parents, kids, and staff.
Yes.
And so school could be anywhere.
That's right.
You know, I've when it comes to the shutdowns, I know we're getting a little off topic here with schools. It's every school is different in terms of ventilation, square footage, kids per classroom. So there's not going to be a one size fits all solution to schools opening back up. But what they all need to do is fundraise for the eventuality of the changes that need to get initiated because the state's not going to do it. And the California Teachers Association is showing no signs of doing it. And so you have to take control of your own destiny as much as you can when it comes to instituting, be the change you wish to see, essentially.
Absolutely.
It always takes that level of personal engagement. And so you're going to need funds to adjust whatever that adjustment is going to look like, whether it's more virtual equipment and technology, whether it's more PPE, you know, or hand sanitizer, whether it's you need to invest in doors that open automatically so you're touching less surfaces, or because the school's square footage is so small that you need to rent out office space or a movie theater that can't be open and operational so you can have 15 kids in a big enough space. I mean, I think the solution lies a lot in parks and community centers and libraries and things like that.
Exactly, because these aren't going to be used for traditional use, so we might as well make them, you know, educational resources and centers for learning. Yep. So let me ask you some other questions. So let's just change the subject. Okay. What has all of this taught you? You know, this, you've been through a lot, I've been through a lot, you know, we're isolating, you're working in the garage, I'm in Mr. Magnificent's man cave. You know, what has this taught you about who you are as a person, who you are as a parent, and who you aspire to be as a man in the world?
You know, if first of all, you can't afford to take your foot off the gas, especially in this kind of environment. It's adapt or die, just like it is in any other business. You're either growing or you're dying. You need to be able to be flexible and willing to learn. If you're not willing to learn something new, no matter how old you are, your viability, you know, are you going to allow yourself to fall into stagnation and be obsolete? I don't have that choice. And a lot of other people don't either. I have two kids. I run a small business. I got nothing protecting me except me. So it always comes down to self-discipline is a lot about what it taught me. And I find a lot of comfort in moving forward, just forward and advance, whatever gets thrown at you, forward and advance. You can't change the past. All you can do is change your trajectory in the future. And I think a lot of people, you know, you can get low. There's no doubt about it. You're a human being. You worked really hard to build up something. Most people were doing pretty good. Not all of them, but 2019 was a good year for a lot of people. And I think you have to let go of whatever that past was. And I've had to learn a whole new side of technology. I just dove right in. I didn't have the luxury of mourning what was lost, because I work for nonprofits. If I lost something, the nonprofit lost something, which means their beneficiaries are the ones who are suffering. I'm not an auctioneer. I do it, but I'm a professional fundraiser, and the nonprofits that hired me to help them fundraise, I still have a contract. Whether we can do a live event or not, it doesn't matter. We have to fundraise. Right. These other diseases didn't go away just because COVID is here. In fact, they got more dire. More people are turning to nonprofits to help them now, more so than ever. And so it's not a good time to raise the white flag. And so if nonprofits aren't waving the white flag, neither should I. I don't have that luxury or choice. I have mouths to feed, and so do they.
Right. So let's talk about that white flag, because everyone's talking about white privilege. And I'm not trying to put anybody in any awkward predicament, but you have worked with the Black Police Officers Association here in San Diego, and I'm sure tons of others. You know, how do we come together to make it green? It's not about, right, it's not about brown, red, blue, white, because we're all in need, and every organization is multicultural at some level. How do we bridge that gap? You got any suggestions?
By coming together and just open-mindedness, really. I think a lot of people are whipped up into the dichotomy of red or blue or black and white. And, you know, tribalism is a problem in my opinion. I think tribalism is a shortcut to thinking and a shortcut to experiencing something new. I think people, they form their opinion based off of what they consume in the media, and then they dig their heels in, which makes them completely and utterly unpliable to accepting new information. Don't be a gigantic boulder on the river of information. Ride that river. Be a pebble that can float. Be a fish that can absorb and experience and travel new things. So
surfer like you, right?
I guess so.
Ride that wave.
There's a lot of waves out there that are, you know, that need to be ridden. And so I think it adds to the vastness and the richness of life. I think there are powerful forces that are kind of doing some divide and conquer work here that are making people look at others with a kind of a you shoot from the hip mentality. You know, that the reinforcing of stereotypes is never a good thing. Whoever is doing it,
it's on both sides. You know,
and that's the thing. I don't think it's about sides. I don't think it's a binary issue. Stop pigeonholing yourself. Right. Really, there is branches that can be offered when you're not so entrenched in vitriol. I'm always for open-mindedness and encouraging outreach to where everyone's trying to survive and maintain equality and maintain peace. And there's obviously vast misunderstandings of what different people want and what different organizations are trying to do. But just know that whenever you're watching the news in America, somebody is selling you something. It's all agenda-driven. And that limits, what's that?
It's created.
But yeah. See,
that's why they are watching podcasts like this, exactly. On the Edge with April Mahoney, because they have options, they have choices, and they're hearing, you know, they're hearing a voice from the underserved, overlooked, unsung heroes like yourself. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I am so glad that you are out there on the battlefield helping people raise some money. Because everybody's not broke brains, okay? Right. Don't believe that, okay? They're holding on to it tight, believe me. But they're not broke, but they are giving to causes that resonate with their heart, that, you know, they're going to see some return on their investment outside of a t-shirt, something that they care about, something that is going to be sustainable and renewable. So, again, keep doing the work that you're doing, Zach, because, you know, like I told you before, I think you're a beast. I absolutely love you. I'm all about the sale. I'm all about the closing of the deal, but I'm also about the value and the return on the investment. Please tell my brains how to get in contact with you. You know, I don't know if you're doing some consultation work, but there's always great nonprofits all over the United States. You may not be able to do auction work in them, but there might be some way that you can collaborate with them or other auctioneers.
The name of my firm is California Coast Auctions, as in cacoastauctions.com. You can learn all about me and watch videos of me and my team doing our events live, which is really not too terribly different on virtual. We do have plenty of clients that are located all over the nation. And we do have studios, as well as the one that I'm building, to be able to conduct that auction from across the country. Really, the technology through various devices allow for that to occur. And as long as you have a good internet connection and you have a viable entertainment for that virtual event, it's going to be successful. And you're going to be laying the groundwork for your foundation for the future and a whole new revenue stream. So don't turn your back on the future. Don't become Blockbuster in Netflix world, is what I like to say. And you'll find all my contact information on that website. I certainly welcome the opportunity to talk to anyone. That's all I do on the 9-to-5 basis. I'm talking to all my current clients, and people are starting to reach out to me now to book me for their virtual events, because I've just found this out. I've done more than anybody else in the country. I was very shocked. I've done 19 virtual fundraisers, which is not a lot in the grand scheme of things, but it's a lot since March. And I just did my last one for Olive Crest last Saturday, and they're a big, wonderful nonprofit that help foster kids and kids in the adoption services world who are in abusive situations, and that need has never been higher. So
did you want to plug the nonprofit that you're a part of as well, personally?
Yeah, sure. I help along with my right-hand man, the most wonderful and talented Vincent Zapien, who is such an amazing human being. He was the first bilingual auctioneer in the country. 30 years ago, he was the first Latino man to say, I want to be an auctioneer. And he had to trailblaze his way through a lot of challenges, and it made him the most beautiful man you've ever met. And we co-founded, he did most of it. I like to front the money for it, called Jesus and Coffee. And Jesus and Coffee did a lot of homeless ministry to the people on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And San Diego sometimes too. We're handing out Bibles and coffee and ministry work, hygiene kits, you know, connecting people with different social services that want to get off the streets, trying to get them to, you know, live a cleaner life as far as, you know, getting off drugs. And the tough part is it's easier to be homeless for a lot of these people.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Coming to accept who you are and coming to think you're, you know, I think that's like the first step of AA is realizing that you're powerless over your addiction. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard step for people to take without someone to show them the way. You know, there's a lot of causes that are very near and dear to my heart. And I always am so excited to work with any group that is trying to combat child trafficking, child abuse. That is a very unspoken demon in our society because it's happening all the time. And I work with the Joyful Child Foundation and Child Help and Olive Crest and Grandma's House of Hope. And there's a lot of groups that do that. And they actually do what some of you say. Some of these people who are, you know, who've sadly been through that, they're making jewelry, you know, and the jewelry is being sold at the event. And that is a method of self-sustainability. And you pretty much developed a co-op around your nonprofit.
Absolutely.
And so that's...
And again, like I said, it's work. Yep. And, you know, that's what it is. It's moving and effort. You know, it's not just this. It's not just a hand up.
Yeah, you can't just be Oliver.
It's not just a hand out. No, it's not. Yeah. And again, people are, me, if I really see that you're putting some effort behind building your own sustainability, I'm team you all the way. Sure. So thank you so much for being here on The Edge with me. Brains, go back. You know where to find me? Right here. Okay, we got all kind of great stuff coming up. We got some jazz artists. We got some comedians. Maybe we got some people that can work with Zach over there to try to get some entertainment for your next fundraiser. You have been a wealth of information. Please, nonprofits and social services and schools, really think about this. I know you got a lot on your plate, but you cannot pour from an empty coffer, baby. You cannot. Yep. So thank you so much again. And like you said, don't be a blockbuster in a Netflix world. I love that.
Love you, April. Right.
And I will talk to you again soon, Brains. Go and subscribe. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Blog Talk, iTunes, Mixcloud. How's that? Rattling
off. That sounds like an auction.
Now all I need to do is close the deal. Thanks so much for being here with me, Zach. Come on back and see me anytime. You always got a seat at the table, all right?
Oh, that's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
All right.
All right.